squad or base, or the lieutenants, who were in charge of the squads. I explained to the other boys that we had arrived just a few minutes before them. They told me that they had been randomly selected too, and asked by their commander to follow the men who visited their base. None of us knew why our commanders had let us go. We were excellent fighters and were ready to fight the war till the end. One boy was telling us that he thought the foreigners gave our commanders money in exchange for us. No one said anything to this. I still had the grenade in my hand as we conversed. Sometime during the conversation, I turned to the man who had brought us to the kitchen. He was sitting at the edge of the table, shaking. His forehead perspired profusely. "Do you know why our commanders gave us up to you sissy civilians?" I asked the man, pointing the grenade at him. He put his head under the table as if I was going to throw the grenade at him. He was too nervous to answer me. "He's a sissy civilian. Let's go ask the other boys," the boy who had pulled his bayonet suggested. His name was Mambu, and I later became friends with him. We left the man, still under the kitchen table, and headed for the veranda. As we walked up the steps, we saw the three MPs sitting at the entrance of the compound, chatting and ignoring us. The two foreigners had left. We walked up to the boys sitting quietly on the veranda. "Do you boys know why your commanders gave you up to these civilians?" Alhaji asked, and all the quiet boys stood up and turned their angry faces to him, staring silently. "Are you boys deaf?" Alhaji continued. He turned to me. "They don't know anything." "We do not want to be bothered by anyone," one of the boys said in a deep voice. "And we do not want to answer any questions from a civilian." "We are not civilians," Mambu said angrily, walking toward the boy. "If anyone is a civilian, it is you boys. You are wearing civilian clothes. What kind of army person wears only civilian clothes? Did these sissy civilians who brought you here make you wear those clothes? You must be a weak soldier then. We fought for the RUF. The army is the enemy. We fought for freedom, and the army killed my family and destroyed my village. I will kill any of those army bastards every time I get a chance to do so." The boy took off his shirt to fight Mambu, and on his arm was the RUF tattoo. "They are rebels," Mambu shouted, and before he could reach for his bayonet, the boy punched him in the face. He fell, and when he got up, his nose was bleeding. The rebel boys drew out the few bayonets they had and rushed toward us. It was war all over again. Perhaps the naive foreigners thought that removing us from the war would lessen our hatred for the RUF. It hadn't crossed their minds that a change of environment wouldn't immediately make us normal boys. We were dangerous and brainwashed to kill. They had just started this process of rehabilitation, so this was one of the first lessons they had to learn. As the boys rushed toward us, I threw the grenade among them, but the explosion was delayed. We leaped out from underneath the stoop where we had taken cover and charged into the open yard, where we began to fight. Some of us had bayonets, others didn't. A boy without a bayonet grabbed my neck from behind. He was squeezing for the kill, and I couldn't use my bayonet effectively, so I elbowed him with all my might until he let go of my neck. He was holding his stomach when I turned around. I stabbed him in his foot. The bayonet stuck, so I pulled it out with force. He fell, and I began kicking him in the face. As I went to deliver the final blow with my bayonet, someone came from behind me and sliced my hand with his knife. It was a rebel boy, and he was about to kick me down when he fell on his face. Alhaji had stabbed him in the back. He pulled the knife out, and we continued kicking the boy until he stopped moving. I wasn't sure whether he was unconscious or dead. I didn't care. No one screamed or cried during the fight. After all, we had been doing such things for years and we're all still on drugs. The three MPs and the two nationals who had brought us to the center came running into the yard a few minutes into the fight. "Stop, stop," they yelled, pushed boys apart and carried the wounded to the side. It was a bad idea. We pounced on the MPs, pulled them to the ground and took their guns away from them. The army boys, we, got one. The rebel boys had the other. The other MP ran away before either group could catch him. Mambu had the gun, and before the rebel boy who had the other gun could switch the safety off, Mambu shot him. He fell, dropping the gun. Other rebel boys tried to grab it, but Mambu shot each one who attempted to. He killed a few and wounded some, but the rebel boys were persistent, and finally one of them got the gun and shot two boys on our side. The second boy, who was shot at close range, stabbed the rebel boy in the stomach before he fell. The rebel boy dropped the gun and fell to the ground as well. More MPs were running through the gate now toward the fight. We had fought for almost 20 minutes, stabbing and slicing each other and the men who tried to part us. The MPs fired a few rounds into the air to get us to stop, but we were still fighting, so they had to part us by force. They placed some of us at gunpoint and kicked others apart. 6 people were killed, 2 on our side and 4 on the rebel side, and several were wounded, including 2 of the men who had brought us. The military ambulances took off, wailing into the still newborn night with the dead and wounded. Their strobe lights made me dizzy. I had a little wound on my hand. I hid it because I didn't want to be taken to the hospital, and it was just a small cut. I washed the blood off, put some salt on it, and tied it with a cloth. During the fight, Mambu had blinded one boy by plucking out his eye with a bayonet. We later heard the boy was taken out of the country for surgery, and that his eye was to be replaced by a cat's eye or something. Following the night of the fight, we praised Mambu for his lethal behavior. I would have liked him to be in my squad, I thought. As MPs stood guard to make sure we didn't start another fight, we the army boys went to the kitchen to look for food. We ate and chatted about the fight. Mambu told us that when he plucked the boy's eye out, the boy ran to punch him, but he couldn't see him, so he ran into the wall, banging his head hard, and fainted. We laughed and picked up Mambu, raising him in the air. We needed the violence to cheer us after a whole day of boring traveling and contemplation about why our superiors had let us go. The jubilation was stopped by a group of MPs who walked into the kitchen and asked us to follow them. They had their guns pointed at us, but we laughed at them and walked outside to where the military vehicles waited to transport us somewhere. We were so happy to have dealt with the rebel boys that we didn't think of attacking the MPs. Plus, there were too many of them. It seemed they had gotten the message that we were not children to play with. Some of the MPs stood by the vehicle holding their guns tightly and carefully eyeing us. "Maybe they are taking us back to the front," Alhaji said. And for some reason, we all started singing the national anthem, marching to the vehicles. But we were not taken back to the front lines. Instead, they took us to Benin Home, another rehabilitation center in Kisii Town at the eastern outskirts of Freetown, away from the rest of the city. Benin Home had once been called Approved School and had been a government-run juvenile center. The MPs made sure to search us thoroughly before we entered. The blood of our victims and enemies was fresh on our arms and clothes. The lieutenant's words still echoed in my head. "From now on, we kill any rebel we see, no prisoners." I smiled a bit, happy that we had taken care of the rebel boys. But I also began to wonder again, why had we been brought here? The MPs guarded us that night as we sat on the veranda of our halls, staring into the night. All I could think about was what was going to happen with my G3 weapon and what movie my squad was watching that night, what good marijuana and cocaine were at their disposal. "Hey, you fellows have any taffy, marijuana, for us?" Mambu asked the MPs, who ignored him. I was beginning to shake. The drugs from the previous nights, before we were brought to the city, had begun to subside in my system. I walked up and down on the veranda, restless, in my new environment. My head began to hurt. Chapter 16. It was infuriating to be told what to do by civilians. Their voices, even when they called us for breakfast, enraged me so much that I would punch the wall, my locker, or anything that I was standing next to. A few days earlier, we could have decided whether they would live or die. Because of these things, we refused to do anything that we were asked to do, except eat. We had bread and tea for breakfast, rice and soup for both lunch and dinner. The assortment of soups consisted of cassava leaves, potato leaves, okra, and so forth. We were unhappy because we needed our guns and drugs. At the end of every meal, the nurses and staff members came to talk to us about attending the scheduled medical checkups in the mini hospital at Benin Home, and the one-on-one counseling sessions in the psychosocial therapy center that we hated. As soon as they started speaking, we would throw bowls, spoons, food, and benches at them. We would chase them out of the dining hall and beat them up. One afternoon, after we had chased off the nurses and staff members, we placed a bucket over the cook's head and pushed him around the kitchen until he burned his hand on the hot boiling pot and agreed to put more milk in our tea. Because of these things, we were basically left to wonder aimlessly about our new environment for the entire first week. During that same week, the drugs were wearing off. I craved cocaine and marijuana so badly that I would roll a plain sheet of paper and smoke it. Sometimes, I searched in the pockets of my army shorts, which I still wore, for crumbs of marijuana or cocaine. We broke into the mini hospital and stole some pain relievers, white tablets and off-white, and red and yellow capsules. We emptied the capsules, ground the tablets, and mixed them together. But the mixture didn't give us the effect we wanted. We got more upset day by day, and as a result, resorted to more violence. In the morning, we beat up people from the neighborhood who were on their way to fetch water at a nearby pump. If we couldn't catch them, we threw stones at them. Sometimes they dropped their buckets as they ran away from us. We would laugh as we destroyed their buckets. The neighbors stopped walking near our center, as we had sent a few of them to the hospital. The staff members avoided us all the more. We began to fight each other, day and night. We would fight for hours in between meals, for no reason at all. During these fights, we destroyed most of the furniture and threw the mattresses out in the yard. We would stop to wipe the blood off our lips, arms, and legs only when the bell rang for mealtime. At night, after we had exhausted fighting, we would bring our mattresses outside in the yard and sit on them quietly until morning arrived and it was time for breakfast. Every time we returned from breakfast, the mattresses we had brought outside the previous night were back on our beds. We would angrily bring them out again in the yard, cursing whoever had taken them inside. One night, as we sat outside on the mattresses, it began to rain. We sat in the rain, wiping it off our faces and listening to its sound on the tile roof and the gushing of torrents onto the ground. It rained for only about an hour, but even after it had stopped, we continued sitting outside all night on the wet sponges that were once our mattresses. The following morning, when we returned from breakfast, the mattresses were still outside. It wasn't much of a sunny day, so they didn't dry by nighttime. We became angry and went to look for Poppy, the man in charge of storage. He was an ex-military man with a wandering eye. When we found him, we demanded dry mattresses. "You will have to wait for the ones you left outside to dry," he said. "We cannot allow a civilian to talk to us like that," someone said, and we all shouted in agreement and rushed at Poppy. We unleashed blows on him. One of the boys stabbed his foot and he fell down. He put his hands over his head as we kicked him relentlessly and left him lying on the floor, bleeding and unconscious. We shouted in excitement as we walked back to our veranda. Gradually we became quiet. I was angry because I missed my squad and needed more violence. A security guy who watched the center took Poppy to the hospital. Several days later, Poppy returned during lunchtime limping, but with a smile on his face. "It is not your fault that you did such a thing to me," he said, as he strode through the dining hall. This made us angry, because we wanted the civilians, as we referred to the staff members, to respect us as soldiers who were capable of severely harming them. Most of the staff members were like that. They returned smiling after we hurt them. It was as if they had made a pact not to give up on us. Their smiles made us hate them all the more. My hands had begun to shake uncontrollably and my migraines had returned with a vengeance. It was as if a blacksmith had an anvil in my head. I would hear and feel the hammering of metal in my head, and these unbearable sharp sounds made my veins and muscles sour. I cringed and rolled around on the floor by my bed or sometimes on the veranda. No one paid any attention as everyone was busy going through their own withdrawal stages in different ways. Alhaji, for example, punched the cement pillar of one of the buildings until his knuckles bled and his bone began to show. He was taken to the mini hospital and put to sleep for several days so that he would stop hurting himself. One day, we decided to break the glass windows in the classrooms. I do not remember why, but instead of finding rocks to break the windows like everyone else, I punched the glass with my fist. I managed to break several panes before my hand got stuck in the glass. I drew it out and began to bleed uncontrollably. I had to go to the hospital. My plan was to steal a first aid kit and treat myself, but the nurse was there. She made me sit on the counter as she removed pieces of glass from my skin. She twisted her face whenever she was removing a piece of glass that was buried deep in my skin, but when she looked at me, I was still. She searched my face to see if I was in pain. She was confused, but continued to gently remove the pieces of glass from my bleeding hand. I didn't feel a thing. I just wanted to stop my blood from flowing. "This is going to hurt," the nurse said when she was about to clean the cuts. "What is your name?" she asked as she dressed my hand. I didn't answer her. "Come back tomorrow so that I can change the bandage, okay?" She began to rub my head, but I pushed her hand away and walked out. I didn't go back to the hospital the next day, but on that same day I fainted from a migraine while I was sitting on the veranda. I woke up in bed in the hospital. The nurse was wiping my forehead with a soaked cloth. I caught her hand, pushed her away, and walked out again. I sat outside in the sun, rocking back and forth. My entire body was aching, my throat was dry, and I felt nauseated. I threw up something green and slimy, then fainted again. When I woke up hours later, the same nurse was there. She handed me a glass of water. "You can go if you want to, but I suggest that you stay in bed tonight," she said, pointing her finger at me, the way a mother would talk to a stubborn child. I took the water from her and drank it, then threw the glass against the wall. The nurse leapt from her chair. I tried to get up and leave, but was unable to sit up in bed. She smiled and walked over to my bed and injected me. She covered me with a blanket and began sweeping up the broken glass. I wanted to throw the blanket off, but I couldn't move my hands. I was getting weaker and my eyelids grew heavier. I woke up to the whispers of the nurse and someone else. I was confused, as I wasn't sure what day or time it was. I felt my head pulsating a little. "How long have I been here?" I asked the nurse, banging my hand on the side of the bed to get her attention. "Look who's talking, and be careful with your hand," she said. When I sat up a bit, I saw that there was a soldier in the room. I thought for a minute that he was there to take me back to the front lines, but when I looked at him again, I knew he was at the hospital for other reasons. He was clearly a city soldier, well-dressed and without a gun. He was a lieutenant and supposedly there to check on how we were being treated medically and psychologically, but he seemed more interested in the nurse. I was once a lieutenant, I thought. A junior lieutenant, to be precise. As a junior lieutenant, I had been in charge of a small unit made up of boys to carry out quick missions. The lieutenant and Corporal Gaddafi had selected all my remaining friends, Alhaji, Kene, Juma, and Murba, to form the unit, and once again we were back together. Only this time, we weren't running away from the war. We were in it, and went out scouting potential villages that had food, drugs, ammunition, gasoline, and other things we needed. I will report our findings to the corporal, and then the entire squad would attack the village we had spied on, killing everyone so that we would stay alive. On one of our scouting expeditions, we accidentally came upon a village. We had thought that the village was more than 3 days away, but after only a day and a half of walking, we began to smell the scent of cooking palm oil in the air. It was a beautiful day, as summer was giving us its last sunshine. We immediately got off the path and walked in the bushes toward the village. When we began to see the thatched roofs, we crawled until we were closer to the village to be able to look at what was going on. There were a few gunmen lazily lounging about. Also, there were piles of bundles outside every house. It seemed that the rebels were getting ready to move out of the village. If we had gone back to base to get the rest of the squad, we would have missed capturing their supply of food. So we decided to attack. I gave orders for everyone to deploy around the village at strategic positions from where they could see the entire place. Alhaji and I gave the three other boys a few minutes to take their positions before we started crawling even closer to the village to initiate the attack. The two of us went back to the main path and started crawling on either side of it. We had two RPG tubes and five propelled grenades. We had gotten close enough, and I had aimed my gun at the group that I intended to start with, when Alhaji tapped me on my shoulder. He whispered that he wanted to practice his Rambo moves before we started firing. Before I said a word, Alhaji was already rubbing mud on his face, using a combination of saliva and some of the water from his backpack to wet the mud. He tied his gun to his back and took out his bayonet, rubbing his finger on the flat edge, holding it in front of his face. He began to crawl slowly under the midday sun that illuminated the village one last time before we brought darkness to it. When Alhaji was out of sight, I aimed the RPG at the village where most of the gunmen sat to cover him. A few minutes later, I saw him crawling and crouching behind and among houses. He would quickly sit against walls to avoid being seen. He crawled slowly behind a lazy guard, basking in the sunlight, with his gun on his lap. Alhaji grabbed the guard's mouth and sliced his neck with his bayonet. He did the same to a few more guards, but he had made one mistake. He didn't hide the bodies of those he had successfully killed. I was enjoying his maneuver when one of the guards, upon returning to his post, saw the body of his colleague and began running back to tell the others. I couldn't let him do that, so I shot him with my G3 and quickly released two RPGs among the gunmen. We began exchanging fire. I didn't know where Alhaji was, but as I was shooting, he crawled toward me. I almost shot him, but recognized his dirty Rambo face. We went to work, killing everyone in sight. We didn't waste a single bullet. We had all gotten better at shooting, and our size gave us an advantage, because we could hide under the tiniest bushes and kill men who wondered where the bullets were coming from. To gain complete control of the village, Alhaji and I shot the remaining RPGs before we descended on it. We walked around the village and killed everyone who came out of the houses and huts. Afterward, we realized that there was no one to carry the loads. We had killed everyone. So I sent Kene and Moriba back to the base to get help. They left, taking some ammunition from the dead gunmen. Some of them still clung to their guns. The three of us remained in the village. Instead of sitting among the dead bodies, the bundles of food, crates of ammunition, and bags of drugs, we took cover in the nearby bushes and guarded the village. Also, we took turns going down to the village to get something to eat and some drugs. We sat quietly under the bushes and waited. 2 days later, Kene and Moriba returned with the corporal, some soldiers and civilians who carried the bundles of food, drugs and ammunition back to base. "We have enough of everything to last us for a few months. Good job, soldiers," the corporal congratulated us. We saluted him and were on our way. Because of this raid, Alhaji acquired the name Little Rambo, and he did all he could in other raids to live up to that name. My nickname was Green Snake, because I would situate myself in the most advantageous and sneaky position and would take out a whole village from under the tiniest shrub without being noticed. The lieutenant gave me the name. He said, "You don't look dangerous, but you are, and you blend with nature, like a green snake, deceptive and deadly when you want to be." I was happy with my name, and on every raid, I made sure I did as my name required. There was a crack on the white ceiling of the room, and I could faintly hear the deep voice of the city lieutenant and the quick laughs of the nurse. I turned my head to the side and looked in their direction. The nurse had a wide smile on her face and seemed to be interested in the lieutenant's jokes. I got up and started walking out of the hospital. "Drink a lot of water and you'll be fine. Come back tomorrow night for a checkup," the nurse called after me. "How do you like being here?" the lieutenant asked. I looked at him with disgust and spat on the ground. He shrugged. "Just another sissy city soldier," I thought, as I walked back to the hall. When I got there, two boys were playing table tennis on the veranda. Everyone seemed to be interested in what was happening. It had been more than a month, and some of us had almost gone through the withdrawal stage, even though there were still instances of vomiting and collapsing at unexpected moments. These outbreaks ended, for most of us, at the end of the second month, but we were still traumatized, and now that we had time to think, The fastened mantle of our war memories slowly began to open. Whenever I turned on the tap water, all I could see was blood gushing out. I would stare at it until it looked like water before drinking or taking a shower. Boys sometimes ran out of the hall screaming, "The rebels are coming." Other times, the younger boys sat by rocks weeping and telling us that the rocks were their dead families. Then there were those instances when we would ambush the staff members, tie them up, and interrogate them about the whereabouts of their squad, where they got their supplies of arms and ammunition, drugs and food. It was also during this time that we were given school supplies, books, pens and pencils, and told that we would have classes from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on weekdays. We made campfires with them, and the next morning another set of supplies was handed to us. We burned them again. The staff members kept resupplying the school materials. This time, they didn't say, "It's not your fault," as they usually did after we had done things they considered wrong and not childlike. One afternoon, after the staff members had set some school supplies on the veranda, Mambu suggested that we sell them. "Who will buy them? Everyone is afraid of us," some of the boys asked. "We can find a trader who wants to do business," Mambu assured the boys. We loaded the supplies in plastic bags, and six of us went to the nearest market, where we sold them to a vendor. The man was excited and told us that he would buy from us anytime. "I don't care whether you stole this. I have the money and you have the goods. We do business," the man told us as he handed Mambu a wad of cash. Mambu counted the crisp notes with a wide smile on his face. He held the bills to our noses so that we could smell them. "This is good money, I can tell," he said. We then ran back to the center to make it in time for lunch. Immediately after we were finished eating, Mambu gave each boy his share of the money. The halls became noisy as everybody talked about what they were going to do with their money. This was definitely more exciting than burning the supplies. While some of the boys bought Coca-Cola, toffee, and other such things with their money, Mambu, Alhaji, and I planned a trip to Freetown. All we knew was that we had to take public transportation to the city center. That morning, we gulped our breakfast and left the dining hall one at a time. I pretended I was going for a checkup at the mini hospital. Mambu went into the kitchen as if to get more food and climbed out the window. Alhaji walked toward the latrine. We didn't want the other boys to know, as we worried that they would all come along and the staff would panic. The three of us met at the junction down by the center and stood in line waiting for the bus. "Have you ever been to the city?" Alhaji asked us. "No," I replied. "I was supposed to come to Freetown for school, but then the war came." "I heard it is a beautiful city," Alhaji said. "Well, we'll find out soon enough. The bus is here," Mambu announced. Suku's music was blasting inside the bus and people were chatting loudly as if at a marketplace. We sat in the back and watched the houses and kiosks go by. A man standing in the aisle began to dance to the music. Then a few passengers, including Mambu, joined in. We laughed and clapped for the dancers. We got off the bus on Kisi Street, a busy area near the heart of the city. People were hurriedly going about their daily lives as if nothing were happening in the country. There were big shops on both sides of the street, and vendors crowded the tiny sidewalks. Our eyes feasted on everything, and we were quickly overwhelmed. "I told you it would be great," Mambu jumped up in the air. "Look at that tall building," I pointed at one. "And that one is so tall," Alhaji called out. "How do people get up there?" Mambu asked. We walked slowly, admiring the number of cars, the Lebanese shops filled with all kinds of foods. My neck was hurting just from looking at the tall buildings. There were mini markets everywhere, selling clothes, food, cassettes, stereos, and many other things. The city was too noisy, as if people were having arguments everywhere simultaneously. We wandered about all the way to the cotton tree, the national symbol of Sierra Leone and the landmark of the capital. We stared open-mouthed at the huge tree we had seen only on the back of the currency. We now stood under it at the intersection of Shaka Stevens Street and Pandemba Road, the center of the city. Its leaves were green, but the bark looked very old. "No one will believe us when we tell them this," Alhaji said as we walked away. We walked around all day buying ice cream and Vinto drinks. The ice cream was difficult to enjoy as it melted too quickly under the hot sun. I spent most of my time licking the sticky residue on my elbows and between my fingers instead of eating it from the cone. As we walked around the city center, the numbers of people and cars increased. We knew no one and everyone seemed to be in a hurry. Mambu and Alhaji walked behind me the whole time and consulted with me about which way to proceed, when to stop. It seemed as if we were still in the front line and I was their squad leader. It was almost evening when we had to return to the center in time for dinner. As we walked back to catch the bus, we realized that we didn't have money to pay the fare. We should sit in the front, and when we get to our stop, we can jump off and run away, Mambu told us. We quietly sat on the bus, eyeing the apprentice, the conductor, who collected the fare before every stop. When the bus was about to reach our destination, the apprentice asked those getting off to raise their hands. He walked down the aisle collecting money. Then the bus stopped, and the apprentice stood at the doorway to make sure that no one got out without paying. I walked toward him, my hand in my pocket, as if I was pulling out the cash. Then I shoved him to the side, and we ran away, laughing. He chased us for a bit, and then gave up. That night, we told all the boys about the tall buildings in the city, the noise, the cars, and the markets. Everyone was excited and wanted to go to the city after that. The staff had no choice but to arrange weekend trips to the city center so that we could stop going on our own. But that wasn't enough for some of us who wanted to visit the city more than once a week. I don't know what happened, but people stopped buying our school supplies. Even when we offered them for a cheaper price, we were unable to get buyers. Since we didn't have any other means of getting money, we could no longer go into the city center on our own, or as frequently as we wanted. Also, attending classes became the requirement for the weekend trips to the city. Because of these things, we began going to class. It was an informal school. For mathematics, we learned addition, multiplication, and long division. For English, we read passages from books, learned to spell words, and sometimes the teacher read stories out loud and we would write them in our notebooks. It was just a way of refreshing our memories, as the teacher put it. We didn't pay attention in class. We just wanted to be present, so we wouldn't miss the trips to the city. We fought each other during lessons, sometimes stabbed each other's hands with pencils. The teacher would continue on, and we would eventually stop fighting. We would then start talking about the ships we had seen from the banks of Crew Bay, the helicopter that flew by as we walked on Lightfoot Boston Street. And at the end of class, the teacher would say, "It's not your fault that you cannot sit still in class. You will be able to do so in time." We would get angry and throw pencils at him as he left the hall. Afterward, we would have lunch, then busy ourselves playing table tennis or soccer. But at night, some of us would wake up from nightmares, sweating, screaming, and punching our own heads to drive out the images that continued to torment us even when we were no longer asleep. Other boys would wake up and start choking whoever was in bed next to theirs. They would then go running into the night after they had been restrained. The staff members were always on guard to control this sporadic outburst. Nonetheless, every morning, several of us were found hiding in the grasses by the soccer field. We didn't remember how we had gotten there. It took several months before I began to relearn how to sleep without the aid of medicine. But even when I was finally able to fall asleep, I would start awake less than an hour later. I would dream that a faceless gunman had tied me up and begun to slit my throat with the zigzag edge of his bayonet. I would feel the pain that the knife inflicted as the man sawed my neck. I would wake up sweating and throwing punches in the air. I would run outside to the middle of the soccer field and rock back and forth, my arms wrapped around my legs. I would try desperately to think about my childhood, but I couldn't. The war memories had formed a barrier that I had to break in order to think about any moment in my life before the war. The rainy season in Sierra Leone falls between May and October, with the heaviest rainfalls in July, August, and September. My squad had lost the base where I had trained, and during that gunfight, Moriba was killed. We left him sitting against the wall, blood coming out of his mouth, and didn't think much about him after that. Mourning the dead wasn't part of the business of killing and trying to stay alive. After that, we wandered in the forest searching for a new base before the wet season started, but we couldn't find one early enough. Most of the villages we came upon weren't suitable, since we had burned them or another group of fighters had destroyed them at some point. The lieutenant was very upset that we hadn't found a base, so he announced that we would keep walking until we found one. At first it began to rain on and off. Then it started to rain continuously. We walked into the thickest forest and tried to escape the downpour by standing under big trees, but it rained to the point where the leaves couldn't hold off the water anymore. We walked through damp forests for weeks. It was raining too hard one morning, and all of a sudden we were under fire. The RPGs we had failed to explode when they were fired. As a result, we retreated. The attackers didn't follow us far enough, so we regrouped again, and the lieutenant said we had to counterattack immediately so that we could follow the attackers. They will lead us to their base, he said, and we advanced toward them. We fought all day in the rain. The forest was wet, and the rain washed the blood off the leaves as if cleansing the surface of the forest, but the dead bodies remained under the bushes, and the blood that poured out of the bodies stayed on top of the soaked soil, as if the soil had refused to absorb any more blood for that day. At about nightfall, the attackers began to retreat. As they were running back, they left one of their wounded men behind. We came upon him, and the lieutenant asked him where their base was. He didn't answer, so someone dragged him with a rope around his neck as we chased the attackers. He didn't survive the drag. At night, the attackers stopped retreating. They had come to the outskirts of their base and were fighting fiercely because they didn't want to give it up. Hit and run, Kalokalo tactics, the lieutenant ordered. We made two groups and launched the attack. The first group opened fire and pretended to retreat. The attackers chased after them, running past the ambush formed by the second group. We quietly got up and ran after the rebels, shooting them from behind. We repeated these tactics throughout the night and severely weakened the rebels. In the morning, we entered the village and killed the remaining fighters who didn't want to leave. We captured 8 of their men, tied their hands and legs, and left them in the rain. There were fireplaces in the village and lots of wood and food. The rebels had stocked up for the rainy season, but now we were the beneficiaries of the looted food and provisions. We changed into the dry clothes we could find and sat around the fire, warming ourselves and drying our shoes. I clutched my gun and smiled for a second, happy that we had found shelter. I extended my toes toward the fire to warm them and saw that they were pale and had begun to rot. We had been in the village for only a few minutes when the rebels attacked again. They didn't want to give up the village easily. We looked at each other sitting around the fire and angrily changed our magazines and went out to get rid of the attackers for good. We fought them throughout the night and the following day. None of us wanted to give up the village to the other, but in the end, we killed most of the rebels and captured a few more. The others ran away into the cold and rainy forest. We were so angry with the prisoners that we didn't shoot them, but rather, we decided to punish them severely. It will be a waste of bullets to shoot them, the lieutenant said. So we gave them shovels and demanded at gunpoint that they dig their own graves. We sat under the huts, smoking marijuana, and watched them dig in the rain. Each time they slowed down, we would shoot around them and they would resume digging faster. When they were done digging, we tied them and stabbed their legs with bayonets. Some of them screamed and we laughed and kicked them to shut them up. We then rolled each man into his hole and covered him with the wet mud. All of them were frightened, and they tried to get up and out of the hole as we pushed the dirt back on them. But when they saw the tips of our guns pointed into the hole, they laid back and watched us with their pale, sad eyes. They fought under the swell with all their might. I heard them groan underneath as they fought for air. Gradually, they gave up and we walked away. At least they are buried, one of the soldiers said, and we laughed. I smiled a bit again as we walked back to the fire to warm ourselves. By the fire, I realized that I had bruises on my arms, back, and foot. Alhaji helped me attend to them with some bandages and medical supplies that the rebels had left behind. It turned out that the bruises were from bullets that had merely torn my flesh as they missed killing me. I was too drugged and traumatized to realize the danger of what just happened. I laughed as Alhaji pointed out the number of bruises on my body. In the morning, I would feel one of the staff members wrap a blanket around me, saying, "This isn't your fault, you know. It really isn't. You will get through this." He would then pull me up and walk me back to the hall. Chapter 17. I had not been to the hospital since I had walked out a few months earlier, while the nurse was chatting with the Sisi City Lieutenant, and she had given up trying to get me to come back for a checkup. But one afternoon, during a table tennis match at which the entire staff was present, I felt someone tap me on the shoulder. It was the nurse. She was wearing a white uniform and a white hat. It was the first time I had looked at her directly. Her white teeth contrasted with her dark, shiny skin, and when she smiled, her face not only increased in beauty, it also glowed with charm. She was tall and had big brown eyes that were kind and inviting. She handed me a bottle of Coca-Cola. "Come and see me whenever you feel like it," she said, smiling as she walked away. The Coca-Cola bottle was cold and it shocked me. I left the game hall with Alhaji and we went outside and sat on a rock, drinking the soft drink. "She likes you," Alhaji teased me. I didn't say anything. "Well, do you like her?" he asked. "I don't know. She's older and she's our nurse," I said. "You mean you're afraid of women?" Alhaji replied, nodding. "I don't think she likes me the way you're thinking about it." I looked at Alhaji, who was laughing at what I had said. After we finished the bottle, Alhaji left and I decided to go to the hospital. When I got to the entrance, I peeked in and saw the nurse on the phone. She motioned for me to come inside and sit. She smiled and made sure that I noticed that it was because of my presence and not her phone conversation. I looked around and saw a chart on the wall with all the names of the boys at the center. In the boxes beside most of the names, there was a check indicating that they had been to at least one session. There was nothing in the boxes across from my name. The nurse took the chart down and put it into a drawer as she hung up the phone. She pulled her chair closer to me, and I thought she was going to ask me a question about the war, but instead she calmly asked, "What is your name?" I was surprised, since I was certain that she knew my name. "You know my name," I angrily said. "Maybe I do, but I want you to tell me your name," she insisted, widening her eyes. "Okay, okay, Ishmael," I said. "Great name," she nodded and continued. "My name is Esther, and we should be friends." "Are you sure you want to be friends with me?" I asked. She thought for a while and said, "Maybe not." I was quiet for a bit, as I didn't know what to say and also didn't trust anyone at this point in my life. I had learned to survive and take care of myself. I had done just that for most of my short life, with no one to trust, and frankly, I liked being alone, since it made surviving easier. People like the lieutenant, whom I had obeyed and trusted, had made me question trusting anyone, especially adults. I was very suspicious of people's intentions. I had come to believe that people befriended only to exploit one another, so I ignored the nurse and began to stare out the window. "I am your nurse, and that's all. If you want to be friends with me, you will have to ask me, and I will have to trust you first," she said. I smiled, because I was thinking the same thing. She was perplexed at first by the sudden smile, but then she said, "You have a great smile. You should smile more." I stopped immediately and tensed my face. "Is there anything that you want from the city?" she asked, but I didn't answer. "That's it for today," she said. A few days after the first conversation, the nurse gave me a present. I was watching some of the boys roll a volleyball net onto the yard. Alhaji returned from his session at the hospital and told me that Nurse Esther said I should go see her. I wanted to watch the volleyball game, but Alhaji began to pull me and didn't let go until we were at the doorway of the hospital. He then shoved me inside and ran away giggling. Lying on the floor, I looked up to see Esther sitting behind her desk, smiling. "Alhaji said you want to see me," I said, getting to my feet. She threw a package at me. I held it in my hand, wondering what it was and why she had gotten it for me. She was looking at me, waiting for me to open it. When I unwrapped it, I jumped up and hugged her, but she immediately held back my happiness. I sternly asked, "Why did you get me this Walkman and cassette, if we are not friends? And how did you know that I like rap music?" "Please sit down," she said, taking the package from me, putting the battery and cassette in the Walkman, and handing it to me. I put the headphones on, and there was Run DMC. "It's like that, and that's the way it is," coming from the headphones. I began to shake my head. Then Esther lifted the headphones off my ears and said, "I have to examine you while you listen to the music." I agreed and took off my shirt, stood on a scale, and she checked my tongue, used a flashlight to look into my eyes. I didn't care because the song had taken hold of me, and I listened closely to every word. But when she began examining my legs and saw the scars on my left shin, she took my headphones off again and asked, "How did you get these scars?" "Bullet wounds," I casually replied. Her face filled with sorrow and her voice was shaking when she spoke. "You have to tell me what happened so I can prescribe treatment." At first I was reluctant, but she said she would be able to treat me effectively only if I told her what had happened, especially about how my bullet wounds were treated. So I told her the whole story about how I got shot. Not because I really wanted to, but because I thought if I told her some of the gruesome truth of my war years, she would be afraid of me and would cease asking questions. She listened attentively when I began to talk. Her eyes were glued to my face, and I bowed my head as I delved into my recent past. During the second dry season of my war years, we were low on food and ammunition, so as usual, we decided to attack another village. First, I went with my squad to spy on a village. We watched the village all day and saw that there were more men than us, and that they were well-armed and had newer guns. I am not sure if they were rebels, because they had fewer boys than any of the other groups we had attacked. Half wore army uniforms and half civilian clothes. We returned to base and I reported my squad's finding to the lieutenant. We immediately left for the village, which is about 3 days' walk. The plan was to first secure the village, then remain there and form a new base instead of bringing the goods back. We left our village that night, alternately walking fast and jogging on the path all night. During the three-day journey, we stopped once a day to eat, drink, and take drugs. We carried with us all the ammunition, guns, and semi-automatic machine guns. Each of us had two guns, one strapped to our back, the other held in our hands. We left only two men behind to guard the base. On the morning of the third day, the lieutenant made us rest longer than we had during the previous days. Afterward, we walked all day and into the evening until the village was in sight. There were many mango, orange, and guava trees in the village, and it looked as if it had been a farm. Surrounding it, we waited for the lieutenant's command. As we lay in ambush, we began to realize that the place was empty. I was lying next to the lieutenant, and he looked at me with a puzzled face. I whispered to him that the village had been full of gunmen a few days ago, even though it now looked deserted. As we continued to watch, a dog strolled across the village, barking as it went down the path. About an hour later, five gunmen entered the village. They took buckets from the veranda of one of the houses and headed toward the river. We were beginning to suspect that something was amiss when a shot was fired from behind us. It was clear now we were being ambushed. The attackers wanted to push us toward the village so they could have us in the open. We exchanged fire all night until morning arrived, at which point we had no choice but to retreat into the village where they wanted us. We had already lost about five men and the rebels were coming at the rest of us. They were up in the mango, orange, and guava trees, ready to rain bullets down on us. My squad scattered, running from one end of the village to the other, crouching behind houses. We had to get out before it was too late. But first we had to get rid of the attackers in the trees, which we did by spraying bullets into the branches to make the rebels fall off them. Those who didn't immediately die were shot before they landed on the ground. To avoid the open area and regroup in the nearby forest, we had to make an opening for ourselves. There was too much firepower surrounding us, so we concentrated our firepower on one area of the forest until everyone was dead. As soon as we had time to gather, the lieutenant once again gave us his little talk about how we had to fight fiercely to capture the village. Otherwise, we'd have to roam the forest looking for another base. Some people were injured, but not so severely as to keep them from fighting. Others, like myself, had received many bullet wounds that they ignored. Our fresh counterattack was carried out in order to secure ammunition from the dead. Then we launched a second fierce attack to gain some control of the village. For more than 24 hours, we retreated and attacked, using the arms and ammunition from those we had killed. Finally, it seemed we had overpowered our rivals. The gunshots had stopped. The bushes behind the mango trees were still. The village, it seemed, was ours. I was filling my backpack with ammunition from a hut when bullets began to rain on the village again. I was hit 3 times on my left foot. The first 2 bullets went in and out, and the last one stayed inside my foot. I couldn't walk, so I lay on the ground and shot into the bush where the bullets that hit me had come from. I released the entire round of the magazine into that one area. I remember feeling a tingle in my spine, but I was too drugged to really feel the pain, even though my foot had begun to swell. The sergeant doctor in my squad dragged me into one of the houses and tried to remove the bullet. Each time he raised his hands from my wound, I saw my blood all over his fingers. He constantly wiped my forehead with a soaked cloth. My eyes began to grow heavy and I fainted. I do not know what happened, but when I woke up the next day, I felt as if I had had nails hammered into the bones of my foot and my veins were being chiseled. I felt so much pain that I was unable to cry out loud. Tears just fell from my eyes. The ceiling of the thatched roof house where I was lying on a bed was blurry. My eyes struggled to become familiar with my surroundings. The gunfire had ceased and the village was quiet, so I assumed that the attackers had been successfully driven away. I felt a brief relief for that, but the pain in my foot returned, causing the veins in my entire body to tighten. I tucked my lips in, closed my heavy eyelids, and held tight to the edges of the wooden bed. I heard footsteps of people entering the house. They stood by my bed, and as soon as they began to speak, I recognized their voices. "The boy is suffering, and we have no medicine here to lessen his pain. Everything is at our former base." The sergeant doctor sighed and continued, "It will take 6 days to send someone to get the medicine and return. He will die from the pain by then. We have to send him to the former base then. We need those provisions from that base anyway. Do all you can to make sure that the boy stays alive," the lieutenant said and walked out. "Yes, sir," the sergeant doctor said, and sighed even longer. I slowly opened my eyes, and this time I could see clearly. I looked at his sweaty face and tried to smile a little. After having heard what they said, I swore to myself that I will fight hard and do anything for my squad after my foot was healed. "We will get you some help. Just be strong, young man," the sergeant doctor said gently, sitting by my bed and examining my leg. "Yes, sir," I said, and tried to raise my hand to salute him, but he tenderly brought my hand down. 2 soldiers came into the house and told the sergeant doctor that the lieutenant had sent them to help take me back to our former base. They took me off the bed, placed me in a hammock, and carried me outside. The sun blinded me at first, and then the treetops of the village began to spin around as they carried me out of the village. The journey felt as if it took a month. I fainted and awoke many times, and each time I opened my eyes, it seemed as if the voices of those who carried me were fading into the distance. Finally, we got to the base and the sergeant doctor went to work on me. I was injected with something. I had no idea we had needles at the base, but in my condition, I couldn't ask what was happening. I was given cocaine as I frantically demanded it. The doctor started operating on me before the drugs took effect. The other soldiers held my hands and stuffed the cloth into my mouth. The doctor stuck a crooked-looking scissors inside my wound and fished for the bullet. I could feel the edge of the metal inside me. My entire body was racked with pain. My bones became sour. Just when I thought I had had enough, the doctor abruptly pulled the bullet out. A piercing pain rushed up my spine from my waist to the back of my neck. I fainted. When I regained consciousness, it was the morning of the next day and the drugs had kicked in. I looked about the room and saw on the table the instruments that had been used for my operation. Next to the instruments was a piece of cloth soaked with blood, and I wondered how much blood I had lost during the operation. I reached my hands down to my foot and felt the bandage before I stood up and limped outside, where some soldiers and the sergeant were sitting. "Where is my weapon?" I asked them. The sergeant handed me the G3 that was on top of the mortar, and I began cleaning it. I shot a couple of rounds sitting against the wall, ignoring the bandage on my foot and everyone else. I smoked marijuana, ate and snorted cocaine and brown. That was all I did for 3 days before we left for the new base we had captured. When we left, we threw kerosene on the thatched-roofed houses, lit them with matches, and fired a couple of RPGs into the walls. We always destroyed the bases we abandoned so that other squads wouldn't be able to use them. Two soldiers carried me in a hammock, but this time I had my gun and I looked left and right as we traveled the forest path. At the new base, I stayed put for 3 weeks and appointed Elijah to be in charge of my expedition squad. I busied myself with drugs and cleaning my gun. The sergeant doctor cleaned my wounds and would always say, "You are lucky." At that time, I didn't think I was lucky. I thought I was brave and knew how to fight. Little did I know that surviving the war that I was in, or any other kind of war, was not a matter of feeling trained or brave. These were just things that made me feel I was immune from death. At the end of the 3 weeks, we had the first batch of attackers. The lieutenant knew they were coming. I tightened the bandage around my foot, picked up my gun, and followed my squad to ambush the attackers before they got anywhere near our village. We killed most of them and captured a few whom we brought back to base. "These are the men responsible for the bullet holes in your foot. It's time to make sure they never shoot at you or your comrades," the lieutenant pointed at the prisoners. I am not sure if one of the captives was the shooter, but any captive would do at that time. So they were all lined up, six of them, with their hands tied. I shot them on their feet and watched them suffer for an entire day before finally shooting them in the head so that they would stop crying. Before I shot each man, I looked at him and saw how his eyes gave up hope and steadied before I pulled the trigger. I found their somber eyes irritating. When I finished telling Esther the story, she had tears in her eyes and she couldn't decide whether to rub my head or hug me. In the end, she did neither, but said, "None of what happened was your fault. You were just a little boy, and any time you want to tell me anything, I am here to listen." She stared at me, trying to catch my eyes so she could assure me of what she had just said. I became angry and regretted that I had told someone, a civilian, about my experience. I hated the "it's not your fault" line that all of the staff members said every time anyone spoke about the war. I got up, and as I started walking out of the hospital, Esther began to speak. "I will arrange for a full checkup at the Connaught Hospital." She paused and then continued. "Let me keep the Walkman. You don't want the others to envy you and steal it. I will be here every day, so you can come and listen to it anytime." I threw the Walkman at her and left, putting my fingers in my ears so I couldn't hear her say, "It's not your fault." That night, as I sat on the veranda listening to some of the boys discuss the volleyball game I had missed, I tried to think about my childhood days, but it was impossible as I began getting flashbacks of the first time I slit a man's throat. The scene kept surfacing in my memory like lightning on a dark rainy night, and each time it happened, I heard a sharp cry in my head that made my spine hurt. I went inside and sat on my bed facing the wall and tried to stop thinking, but I had a severe migraine that night. I rolled my head on the cold cement floor, but it didn't stop. I went to the shower room and put my head under the cold water, but that didn't help either. The headache became so severe that I couldn't walk. I began to cry out loud. The night nurse was called. She gave me some sleeping tablets, but I still couldn't fall asleep, even after my migraine stopped. I couldn't face the nightmares I knew would come. Esther got me to tell her some of my dreams. She would just listen and sit quietly with me. If she wanted to say anything, she would first ask, "Would you like me to say something about your dream?" Mostly I would say no and ask for the workman. One afternoon, Esther wasn't supposed to work, but she came to the center wearing a jean skirt instead of her normal white uniform. She came in a white Toyota with two men. One of the men was the driver and the other was a field worker for children associated with the war, CAW. This was a Catholic organization that partnered with UNICEF and NGOs to create centers like ours. "We are going to the hospital for your examination, and after that, we will give you a tour of the city." Esther was excited. "What do you say?" she asked me. "Okay," I agreed. I was always excited to go to the city. "Can my friend Elijah come?" I asked. "Sure," she said, as she knew I would ask. As we drove into Freetown, the field worker introduced himself. "My name is Leslie. It is a pleasure to meet you, gentlemen." He turned around from the front seat and shook our hands. He sat back and studied us in the rearview mirror. Esther sat between Elijah and me in the back seat. She tickled us and sometimes put her arms around us. I resisted this affection, and she would put both her arms around Elijah. I would look away, and she would softly elbow me before putting her arms around me again. At the center of the city, Esther pointed out the post office, shops, the UN building, and the cotton tree. On Wallace Johnson Street, traders played loud music and rang bells to attract customers. Boys and girls carried coolers on their heads, shouting, cold ice, cold ginger beer." The city always amazed me, with its busy people hurrying up and down, and its traders noisily creating its unique sound. I was watching one ringing a bell and throwing the second-hand clothes he was selling up in the air to attract passers-by when our car stopped at the hospital where I was to be examined. The doctor kept asking, "You feel anything?" as he touched and squeezed parts of my body where I had been wounded or shot. I was beginning to get upset when he told me he was finished. I put my clothes on and came into the waiting area where Esther, Leslie, and Elijah sat. They were smiling, and Esther walked up and pulled on my nose to cheer me up. We strolled over to the market area we had driven past. I spent most of my time studying a rack of cassettes under a kiosk. Esther and Elijah looked at soccer jerseys, and she bought him one. Leslie bought me a Bob Marley cassette. It was the Exodus album. I grew up on reggae music, but had not heard it for a while. As I looked at the cassette, trying to remember the songs, my head began to hurt. Esther must have noticed what was happening to me, because she took the cassette from me and put it in her bag. "Who wants Coca-Cola?" she asked. I was excited and ran ahead to the Coca-Cola stand. She bought us each a bottle. It was cold and it teased my teeth. I savored it as we drove back to the center. I was in high spirits, smiling all the way. Leslie took this opportunity to tell me that he had been assigned to me and a few other boys. Part of his job was to find a place for me to live after I completed my rehabilitation. "If you ever need to talk to me at any time, go to Esther's office and she will call me, okay?" I nodded in agreement, with the Coca-Cola bottle in my mouth. Before Esther got into the car that evening to go home, she pulled me aside and crouched down to look at me directly. I avoided eye contact, but she wasn't discouraged. She said, "I will keep the Bob Marley tape and bring it back tomorrow, so come by and listen to it." She got in the car and waved as they drove off. Elijah had already put on his jersey and was running around playing imaginary soccer. When we got back to the veranda, everyone marveled at Elijah's new jersey. It was green, white, and blue, the colors of the national flag, and it had number 11 on the back. Elijah walked up and down the veranda, showing off. He finally stopped and announced, "I know the city like the back of my hand. I know where to get the goods." He wore the jersey for almost a week without taking it off except to shower, because he knew that someone would try to steal it. He began doing business with his shirt. He would lend it to the boys for a few hours in exchange for toothpaste, soap, lunch, and so on. At the end of the week, he had a lot of toothpaste and other items that he sold at an outdoor market farther away from the center. The day after we returned from the city, I went to the hospital immediately after class and waited for Esther. She was surprised to find me waiting for her at the doorstep. She rubbed my head and said, "I have good news. Your results from the test came. The doctor said nothing is seriously wrong. I just have to make sure you take certain medicines, and in a few months we will do another checkup." She opened the door, and I followed her without saying a word. She knew what I wanted. She gave me the Bob Marley cassette and the Walkman, along with a really nice notebook and a pen. "You can write the lyrics of the songs you like on the album, and we can learn to sing them together if you want." She began making a call. How did she know I love to write song lyrics, I thought, but didn't ask. Later, after I had been rehabilitated, I learned that Esther knew what I was interested in through the informal schooling at the center. In the short classes that we attended, we had been given questionnaires as a form of exam. The questions were general in the beginning. They didn't provoke any difficult memories. What kind of music do you like? Do you like reggae music? If so, who do you like? What do you listen to music for? These were the sorts of questions we would either discuss in class or write a short answer to. Our answers were then given to the nurses or whoever was in charge of our individual counseling sessions. I began to look forward to Esther's arrival in the afternoons. I sang for her the parts of the songs I had memorized that day. Memorizing lyrics left me little time